Following views and opinions do not necessarily reflect those of Talk 1230 WYTS, its staff, management, or parent company, Clear Channel. Listeners should not use Dr. Kvitko's comments and advice in place of receiving an actual dental exam. Time now for Dentally Speaking on Talk 1230 WYTS with Dr. Brian Kvitko. Call 821-1230. That's 821-1230 to discuss your dental issues. Now here's Dr. Kvitko on Talk 1230 WYTS.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. I'm general dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko. Our show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but we're too numb to ask. Today we're going to be talking about the history of dentistry. Actually, we've done a couple segments on that already. One you'll find on the podcast. Actually, you'll find them both on the podcast, so let me give you that that link. It's www.talk1230wyts.com. And if you go there, hold the icon over the on-air button. Names will pop up of all of the on-air personalities on Talk 1230. People like Jim Rome and Dave Ramsey and Gary Sullivan and Laura Ingram. And if you go down to the bottom, you'll find the most important name, Dr. Kvitko. Just kidding, of course. Anyway, click on that. It takes you to my page. And on that page, underneath the smile, it says click here to go to podcast page, and you'll be able to listen to any of our previous shows. So if you want to get the history of dentistry from the beginning, part 1 aired September 7th, part 2 September 14th, and today we're going to do part 3, and actually this should be the final chapter of the history of dentistry. All right. Now, keep in mind that we welcome your questions and comments and also your guesses to our question of the day. And the number here is 821-1230. You can also send an email with your question or guess to dentallyspeakingontalk1230@yahoo.com. And by the way, today's question of the day is this. A survey of dentists revealed how many dentists accept Medicaid. All right, so basically, how many dentists are willing to accept government-backed welfare-type benefits to work on folks to do dental care for these folks? In these times of economic woes, obviously there are more people falling through the cracks than ever before, and you know, I think that dentistry and medicine, for that matter, I think we've done a good job of taking care of people in need. Obviously, there is room for improvement, but there was an article in the October 15th, 2008 Columbus Dispatch entitled Free Medical Dental Services Are in Demand, and it says needy patients turn to hundreds of area doctors who donate time. Now, I happen to be one of them. I do a lot of gratis work through a program here in Ohio administered by the Ohio Dental Association called Options. And it's designed for people who have an income but typically don't earn enough to pay for the work themselves and maybe don't have dental insurance through their employer. And there is a screening process, and you can call the Ohio Dental Association if you feel like you're one of those folks and see if they can't help you. There are different levels. There is the notion that you could qualify for free care or could be simply discounted care. Some dentists just do some donated services on their own. I do through Options as well as some on my own and do my best. Now, on the other hand, keep in mind that unless an office is successful, is solid, they can't afford to do this. And so we, as a nation, need to make sure that these offices are on solid financial ground. And I know whenever I hear comments about let's tax the businesses more, it makes me nervous because I think it'll limit my ability to give back and do as much free work as I am now able to do. And our question of the day then, which is how many dentists provide, or rather accept, Medicaid, we have some quotes from dentists that we'll read later, because it is a topic that I think is an interesting topic and one that we should discuss as a group. But in order to not give away the answer too soon, I think we'll save that discussion for later. But But anyway, okay. And then the other thing is those of you that have been tuned in know that the last couple weeks we had Dr. L. Stephen Buchanan on, who is an endodontist from Santa Barbara, California. And we received several questions, many of which we did not have time to get to. And so what I want to do today is try to finish up that discussion, so you can think of this as endodontics part three in a way. Finish up that discussion and answer the questions that that did come in. Maybe not all of them, but here I'll try to get through a few of them. So here's a question. It's, why would it take two or three visits to get my root canal done? This was sent in from Sam in Amanda, Ohio. And Sam, I mean, I think it depends on the dentist. It depends on the time. Depends on the root system of your tooth, how infected you are. Honestly, more often than not, I accomplish a root canal in one visit. That's my preference. But if you're really, really swollen, I mean, literally, if there's pus coming out of your tooth once the once we open up into it, sometimes it's best just to temporize it and get you back. Another reason it might take a few visits is if you have some pretty intricate roots or an extra root, calcification, something that's just not cooperating, and it just takes that much longer. But in general, the vast, vast majority of root canals can be done in one appointment. Here's a question from somebody. I don't think I got their name. Why did my face stay numb for almost a year? Now, actually, that's pretty uncommon. I've actually never had that happen in my case. Although I have had people that put off getting their root canal done, or they didn't realize, I guess, they had an abscess, hadn't been to anyone in a while. And then when they finally came in, it was because, in this case, for example, their chin was numb, and they wanted to find out why. I took an x-ray, which revealed that they had this very large abscess around a lower anterior tooth, and essentially the pressure was building up down there and putting pressure on the surrounding nerves, causing a numbness. Now, this numbness went away after the root canal was accomplished and the person healed. So once the all the pathoses went away, everything with the bone filled in, everything went back to normal, and all was well. With a patient who has this numbness for several months after a root canal, all I can think of is in that case it may have been so, so infected that it took a long time to fill in. In fact, about 2 weeks ago I was asked to remove some impacted root tips. Previously, this patient had had some teeth extracted. Somehow, a couple root tips were left behind. And in the process of getting a denture, of course, we don't want to have any impacted teeth or portions of teeth left, because if we do, those teeth can become cystic, can get infected, and obviously then affect the fit of the denture and the overall health of the patient. So I went in to remove those, you know, made my incision, removed a little bit of bone to access them, and when I got in there, I found that this, and there was a huge infection. All this, maybe shouldn't be too graphic, but this green, pussy, ugly material that had grown around these impacted tooth root tips. And the hole that was being generated in their bone was very, very significant. And kind of scary, because they didn't even know it was there. We were just doing it because we knew not to place a new denture over an impacted root tip. And so it would take a while for that bone to fill in, and it's possible the person who had this numbness after the root canal was dealing with much the same thing. Here's a question. What material is used to fill the tooth, meaning the root canal filler? Well, more often than not, the root canal filler is called gutta percha. That's G-U-T-T-A-P-E-R-C-H-A. And that comes from some type of a natural tree, an Arpeggian rubber tree. It's natural, it's inert, which means it does not react with tissues. And what it does is, being rubber, it allows us to push it into these tiny little openings and create a plug or a seal. And once we've done that, then the body can take care of whatever bacteria are left in the jawbone, because the bacteria can no longer hide up inside the hollow tooth. Question here is, what can happen if I choose not to have a root canal? Well, nothing good is the answer to that. And You will find that you will eventually get a very painful tooth. You may get a fistula, which is a draining abscess, a pus coming out the side of a hole in your gum. In these people, you may not have any pain at the time, but you will. Unless you have that fistula, and then if you have the fistula, you might not even have pain, but that doesn't mean you don't have an abscess or an infection. It just means you don't have pain at the moment. And think about it. I've done this a time or two. It is very gross, and I understand that, and I kind of apologize to the patient for it. But when people sit in my chair, and I say, you have pus draining out the side of your gum here, you need a root canal, and they say, but it doesn't hurt. Why do I need a root canal? You know, I don't really have the money right now. Can I just do nothing? I'll kind of reach in and grab a little bit of that pus on my instrument. You might want to turn away from the radio. And I'll ask them if they'll lick it off my instrument. And of course, it grosses them all out. And it's like, oh, how could you say that? And the reality is they're swallowing it anyway. And so if that grosses you out, and it should, and you have one of those fistulas in your mouth, you should have your root canal. No questions asked. How long does a root canal take? And that depends on the dentist. It depends on the number of roots. And honestly, a front tooth with a single root probably can accomplish the root canal in about, 15 to 30 minutes. Of course, we still have to put a filling and oftentimes a crown on there. A back tooth, a molar with three or four roots, that can take, you know, an hour, maybe more, for that portion of it. And then the same person asked, why do I need a crown after root canal? And the answer to that is because teeth that have had root canals will get dry and brittle, and over time they can tend to crack or develop craze lines, fracture lines. So because it no longer has the fluid supply, it no longer has a source of nutrients, then you'll want to have the crown placed, because that then is like encasing the tooth in something solid, and it will take care of your tooth over the long haul. All right, now let's see. A few more here. Question here is, how does someone get a pulp stone? Now, for those of you that don't know, if you look on some x-rays, you'll see this, what looks like a little bitty pebble inside the person's root canal system. And you don't just get them. You happen to be born with them. It's an anomaly. There's no consequence of them other than the fact that in some cases they can be in the way of us dentists trying to do a root canal. But usually we can get in there and, you know, trim them away, get them out of our way, and do the root canal just fine. What is the benefit of having a root canal over extracting the tooth? Well, you get to keep the natural equipment you were born with. You don't affect the adjacent two teeth by maybe needing a bridge or an implant. It's cheaper, always cheaper to save your own tooth than it is to have a replacement. And if you have your tooth out and don't have a replacement, then everything else starts to shift. And before you know it, your teeth are all crooked over there and you wish that you had had the root canal back when you had the chance. So that kind of answers that next question, which is, why can't I just have my tooth pulled? Okay, let's see. This one. Why do root canals have such bad feedback from patients, yet the dentist says there should be no pain? Very, very good question. I have no idea. I don't know what's happening out there. I just know that at my office, in my hands, root canals are pretty much nothing. People don't seem to have that discomfort, and I'm not sure how that came about. Maybe it's something the comedians have gotten a hold of and it's just not gone away. Although there are some cases where the tooth is just what we call a hot tooth. People have waited too long. And it can be difficult to numb them. But as you may know from listening to my show, I do the conscious sedation, IV sedation. So there's never a case where a root canal has to be an unpleasant event. Now, we are coming up to a break. And when we come back from the break, we have just a few more of these question and answers, and then we will get on to History of Dentistry Part 3. Remember, our question of the day is, how many dentists do you believe by percentage accept Medicaid? You're listening to Talk 1230 WYTS, Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Talk 1230 WYTS, you're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Good morning, I'm General Dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko. Our show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but We're Too Numb to Ask. So, If you've been in the dental chair and you had questions and you just couldn't ask, well, you're not numb today. You're not numb at sitting there at home, so now's your chance to call in with your question. And even though we are talking about root canals and we're going to talk about the history of dentistry, we'll be happy to answer a general question if you have one. Now remember, our question of the day is, what percent of dentists accept Medicaid patients? And we'll get to that, as well as a little discussion later. All right, we're finishing up this list of questions I received by email and otherwise on root canals as a follow-up to our last two shows. And we're almost done here. So here's one that says, on my x-ray, my doctor showed me that the root canal filler was out the end of the root. How much is allowed? Okay, that's a very good question because you take an x-ray of a root canal, you see some of that material that sticks out the end of the root, and you think, oh, gee, must be a problem. Well, remember I said the material is inert, which means it does not react with tissue. So as long as it's not out really far, and honestly there are cases where even that's okay, it's not an issue. It would be worse if it were not to quite to the end of the root, because then you have this little area where bacteria can get up inside the root tip and hide from your bloodstream and still have an active infection going on. Obviously, you don't want it to Timbuktu, but you do. But you don't have to worry if it's out a little bit. On that same note, this person asked, what about, I had a case where I was getting a root canal and a piece of the file that the dentist was using broke off in the canal. And he went ahead and sealed up my root canal anyway. Should I be worried? Well, that's also a good question. Keep in mind that the material that those files are made out of is titanium. It's the same material that pins and screws that are used to fix knees and wrists and artificial hips. It's the same material that is used for those, which means that too is inert. And as long as your dentist was able to get beyond the obstruction, in this case the titanium file, and seal the tooth root, it really doesn't matter that there is a piece of an instrument in there. So, don't worry about that. Okay, let's see. This one says, what do you do if you've had a root canal and there is still pain? Well, there's going to be some pain or discomfort right after a root canal because you're not healed yet. And I think this is an important thing that I want to touch on. And that is, there seems to be this feeling out there in the, among the patient population that if you go to a dentist, you have something done, that when your numbness wears off, you should be absolutely perfectly healthy and happy. Not a single residual, nothing sore at all. And if you are sore, you think something must be wrong. Well, I try to get my people to realize this is surgery. It's microsurgery, of course, but it's still surgery. And I don't know that there's a person out there who, after knee surgery, expects to be able to walk normally, let alone run. And in fact, you probably are going to limp for a while if you've had an artificial knee or a knee replaced. And that is considered normal. Well, when it comes to dentistry, it's pretty much the same thing. There's trauma, and there's, you know, the numbing, there's all the activity that goes on in there, stretching your lips, and everything you can imagine. And so expect, with a lot of our procedures, it's going to be a little unpleasant for a little while after you get out of the chair. And just maybe just temper your expectations a little bit, and I think you'll be fine. Just a couple more here. My tooth is very painful, but my x-rays don't show an abscess. Do I still need a root canal? If your dentist says you need a root canal, yes. Now, what if it doesn't show on the x-ray? And how could you need a root canal if it doesn't show on the x-ray? The answer is, it's not showing up yet. All right? It takes about 30% destruction of the area that the x-ray tube is x-raying to show up. So let's just say you were x-raying a piece of wood. Let's take a picture of 2x4 in the long way. So we've got a 2-foot-wide piece of wood, and you're going to x-ray it from one end to the other. And that's going to show up a certain intensity on the x-ray film. And let's say that in that wood, let's say that you went and you took a router and you carved out about 25%, about a fourth of that, you carved a big hole in the middle. And you x-rayed it again from left to right, the long way. Okay, it's 2 feet long, and you've got your x-ray tube at the left edge and your x-ray film at the right edge, and now you have a 20%, 25% of the width hole there. when you take that x-ray, it's not going to look any different than the one without the hole. Why? Because you have 75% of it is still good solid wood, and it will show up as good solid wood. It won't be until you were to take your router and make it a 30% hole, okay, three-tenths of the width of the wood, before you would start to see something a little bit different, maybe just a little change. You don't even know if you're seeing it. It might be your imagination at that point. Well, that's what happens in cases of abscessed teeth. You can have an abscess and just have it not be quite to that 30% of a bone loss or obstruction of the bone before it shows up. So yes, now, I have no cavities, but my dentist said I need a root canal because of an infection. How can my tooth get to the point of needing a root canal? Teeth need root canals for a couple reasons. Either trauma, which has exposed the nerve, or decay, which has exposed the nerve. I'm sorry, the trauma would be fracturing, exposing the nerve. And then the other trauma, which is it absorbs the blow, the tissues swell up inside this hard chamber known as a tooth, cuts off its own blood supply, and dies. Like the little balloons that the clowns use, you know, those little skinny balloons, you twist those off. Once you've twisted that off, if it stays twisted for a while, and now we're talking about veins and arteries and nerves, they will die, and that's how you can wind up needing a root canal. So, that pretty much goes through the list of questions that we were still hanging on to from the other day, and finishes up our two-and-a-half part series on root canals. So when we return, we are going to then finish up the history of dentistry, which we're calling History of Dentistry Part 3. Remember that our phone number is 821-1230, and the question of the day is, do you accept Medicaid? This was a poll of dentists, and I'll give some of your guesses here on the air when we return. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230 WYTS. Talk 1230 WYTS, good morning. Thank you for joining me. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko, and I'm general dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko. And today we're talking about the history of dentistry. Of course, we just finished up a discussion about root canals, which was kind of the final phase of our two-part series on root canals. We just went over a few of the questions we did not have time to get to over the last couple weeks. Over the break and through email, we have a couple of guesses for our question of the day. One was sent in by Timothy, and his guess is that 80% of dentists accept Medicaid. Thank you for your guess, Timothy. That's not correct, but I do appreciate it. And then we also had a call during the break from Edward, and Edward says that 75% of dentists accept Medicaid. And thank you, Edward. That's not correct either, but we do appreciate it. We will give the answer here in a little bit. So remember, the phone number 821-1230. Keep your guesses coming. All right, now, as I mentioned, and you can hear parts 1 and 2 on the podcast, which is www.talk1230wyts.com. And we had talked about, we covered dentistry basically from medieval and the Renaissance period all the way up through the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. And where we left off was 1930 to 43. And so here's the newest information. It says that, or where we want to pick up is 1933. All right, so in 1933, the first national board dental examinations are conducted. There were 83 candidates examined in four different cities. That's a good thing, because what that does is standardizes, it makes sure that the public is safety is taken care of, make sure that everyone out there that has the degree or the license to practice dentistry is actually competent. Now, when I was in dental school, I thought, well, gee, I just finished dental school, and if I can do this, I should be allowed to practice. But I now understand that each state or states, they have to be sure for themselves, so they set up these exams that we all have to do. And there, on live patients, we're probably the only profession that actually still uses live patients. 1938, the nylon toothbrush, the first made with synthetic bristles, appeared on the market. So it was the first time toothbrushes had synthetic bristles, 1938. 1937, and I'm not sure why we're out of order here, Alvin Strock inserts the first Vitalium dental screw implant. Vitalium, the first successful biocompatible implant material, had been developed a year earlier by Charles Venable, an orthopedic surgeon. Now, dental implants, as we know them, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, dental implants that I would say I use in my office, they actually, some of the early research on those was done right here at Battelle and OSU, Dr. Bobby Joe Downs, and I'm not sure who he was working with at Battelle at the time, back in, say, 1972, 73, 4, 5, 6, 7, around there. And they were using baboons as models, and the earlier ones were being rejected. And so a lot of work went into the design of dental implants, but the material itself, think about this, 1937 is when a material that would be compatible with the body was first developed. In the 1940s, 22,000 dentists served in World War II. Of course, World War II basically, you know, changed everything in this country. It's the reason women went into the workforce. It's a lot of things like a lot of new advances were developed during that war, things like penicillin, where the government was forced to try these drugs out on massive amounts of people, in this case soldiers, in hopes of protecting them. And so there were years and years and years of study that were accomplished in just a few short years because of the numbers of people that were subjected to this this new medicine. 1945 is when the water fluoridation area began, and that's when the cities of Newburgh, New York, and Grand Rapids, Michigan added sodium fluoride to their public water systems. This is 1945, which is, what is that, 68 years ago? That's a long time. On the other hand, there are still communities today that don't have fluoridated water, and there are still people out there fighting it. And the data is very conclusive. It's of much benefit to the public at large, and I just wish that all of the communities would do that. In 1948, President Harry S. Truman signs the congressional bill formally establishing the National Institute of Dental Research and initiating federal funding for dental research. The name changes to National Institute of Dental and Cranial Facial Research in 1998. So just 10 years ago, the name was changed, but it was 1948 when that was started. President Harry S. Truman did that. In the 1950s, the first fluoride toothpastes were marketed. And fluoride is just this wonderful thing that decreases decay immensely. And I can spot a child almost a mile away who was not raised on fluoridated water. And we've actually seen a slight increase in the amount of tooth decay in some children, because what's happening is parents, well-meaning parents, are using either bottled water or filtered water at home, not realizing that they're filtering out the fluoride, and so they're kind of dooming their children to cavities. And there is now, or are products available called bottled water for kids, and that's water where the fluoride has been put back in the amount of concentration that is appropriate or optimum for good dental health. All right. So if you're one of those parents who is using the bottled water, please keep your children in mind. And it has been shown to be safe and very, very effective. It will save you a lot of money if you make sure your children have fluoride. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the fluoride toothpaste that we mentioned were first started in the 1950s. And as we move forward on our discussion of the history of dentistry, we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230 WYTS. Good morning, everybody. It's 44 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230 WYTS. I'm general dentist Dr. Brian Kavitko, and we're talking about the history of dentistry. In our case, it's the history of dentistry part 3. Parts 1 and 2 can be found on our website, on the podcast, and that is www.talk1230wyts.com. All right, so in 1950s, when the first fluoride toothpaste were marketed, well, I just wanted to mention that fluoride toothpaste is great as long as the fluoride is available for use by your teeth. And so some brands, just because it has fluoride in it, doesn't mean it will benefit you. So I'm making this up, but let's say Fred has his own toothpaste. So Fred's toothpaste with fluoride. Buying Fred's toothpaste with fluoride doesn't ensure your teeth will actually get the fluoride, because if that molecule is bound too tightly to the base molecule and it's not released at the time it needs to be, you just spit it out or swallow. Okay? So I recommend that you use toothpaste that are ADA approved, and what that means is the ADA scientists have studied the product and shown that it is actually effective. All right. 1949, Oskar Hager, a Swiss chemist, developed the first system of bonding acrylic resin to dentin. So dentin bonding, way back in 1949. Dentin, by the way, is the material underneath the enamel covering. The white part that you see underneath that is dentin. In 1955, Michael Bonacore describes the acid etch technique, which is a simple method of increasing the adhesion of acrylic fillings to enamel. So in 1955, now we can bond things to enamel. 1957, John Borden introduces a high-speed air-driven contra-angle handpiece. The air rotor obtains speeds of up to 300,000 rotations per minute and is an immediate commercial success, launching a new era of high-speed dentistry. That, by the way, is that high-speed whine that you hear when you're in the dental office. And today's high-speed drills actually travel at 430,000 rotations per minute. Although, as soon as we touch it to a tooth, it kind of slows down to about 125,000 RPMs. Now, what's neat about that is because it's so fast, it cuts quicker and doesn't generate as much heat or vibration, and it's also why we use the water spray to keep it cool. All right, 1957, the Social Security Act is amended to include self-employed dentists. Not so sure that was a good day for dentistry because kind of put us into that higher tax bracket. 1958, a fully reclining dental chair is introduced. So it used to be that the chairs did not recline. You sat up almost like a barber chair. In fact, they look like a barber chair. And in 1958, this chair that reclines the patient all the way back, some people don't really like it, but what it did was it made it easier on dentists, honestly, because dentists used to complain of back pain, especially in their older years. And now they can, when they sit, they can practice a little bit easier and a little bit longer and not be hunched over, I guess, by the time they get up into their older years. 1960s, a sit-down four-handed dentistry became popular. This technique improves productivity and shortens treatment time. So there aren't very many dentists out there that don't function without a dental assistant. And so it's called four-handed dentistry. And you all, I believe, know what I'm talking about, although there might still be a few practitioners out there trying to do it all themselves. Also in the 1960s, lasers are developed and improved for soft tissue procedures. And I use a soft tissue laser for cosmetic gingival contouring and some minor procedures. And I think they're great. They don't have the whine. There's no sound associated with them at all. And it's actually really neat. In 1960, the first commercial electric toothbrush was developed in Switzerland after World War II and was introduced in the United States. And a cordless, rechargeable model followed in 1961. Hard to think of it being that long ago. What is that, 47 years ago that we had the first electric toothbrush, especially the one that's rechargeable. In 1962, Raphael Brown developed what is called BIS-GMA, the thermoset resin complex used in most of the modern cosmetic resin materials that we now use. In the 1980s, Per Ingvar Brennemark describes techniques for the osseointegration of dental implants. And Brennemark is still in business today. It's a company that sells dental implants. Very well known, very well thought of, and of course other companies have been spawned since then. In 1989, the first commercial home bleaching product is marketed. I actually whitened my teeth in the office. I did it myself back in about 1985. They are still white. Those of you that have met me will notice that my upper teeth are much whiter than my lower. And that's because I just did my upper, and I used myself as an example. In 1990s, actually, we do have to go to a break here, so I'll finish this up here when we come back from the break, and then we will give the answer to our question of the day. So, you're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230 WYTS. We'll be right back. Talk 1230 WYTS. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kavitko. Good morning and thank you for joining me. I'm general dentist Dr. Brian Kavitko, and we're finishing up our discussion on the history of dentistry with just a couple more points to make before we get on to giving the answer of our question of the day. All right, in the 1990s, new tooth-colored restorative materials plus increased usage of bleaching veneers and implants inaugurated an era of aesthetic dentistry. Now, aesthetic dentistry or cosmetic dentistry is still not a recognized specialty in this country, but there's a chance it will be someday. But it's a whole other arm of dentistry that is really great, something that I do a lot of, and I'm so happy to do it because people absolutely love the things that we're able to do for them. In 1997, the FDA approves the erbium YAG laser, the first for use on dentin to treat tooth decay. So here's a case where the laser is now able to cut on hard tissue, not just soft. And although it is just the decayed part, honestly, in my opinion, takes a little bit longer to do than if you were just using the drill. I'm not yet sure lasers are ready to replace the dental drill. In fact, I know they're not. Because if they were, I'd be just using the laser. Now, before we go to our question of the day and switch the discussion slightly, I want to let people know that right here in Ohio, we have a dental museum. So if you are interested in going and seeing some of the history for yourself, it's called the John Harris Dental Museum. It is located at 209 Main Street in Bainbridge, Ohio. And the zip there is 45612. And their phone number is 740-634-2228. I've not been there yet, but I think it'd be cool to visit, and I probably will. They also have another number, 740-634-2246. And they're open on Sundays from 1 to 4, Tuesdays from 12 to 4, Wednesday 12 to 4, Thursday 12 to 4, Friday 12 to 4, and Saturday 12 to 4. So, you know, it costs $2 to get in. It's pretty neat. The reason that it's called the John Harris Dental Museum is it's located at the former residence of Dr. John Harris, and it's also the site of the school which he founded, which specialized in dentistry. Two of Dr. Harris's students went on to found the first two dental colleges in the United States, and therefore this museum has been designated as the cradle of dentistry. You'll find a variety of artifacts, such as office chairs, drills, and other items from different time periods in history, and see the house as it may have been back in 1825. So I think that would be a fun visit. Also, I wanted to let you know that there is a National Dental Museum, and it is in Baltimore, Maryland. National Museum of Dentistry, and their phone number is 410-706-0600. And it's at the University of Maryland, 31 South Green Street, Baltimore, Maryland, 21201-1504. And their website is www.dentalmuseum.umaryland.edu. And I think that it would be also a neat thing to visit because what I've seen of it is where they have a chance for children to interact, to pretend that they're the dentist, maybe pretend that they're the patient, and they have life-size models of teeth, and it just looks like a fun place to be. There's a, you know, they talk about George Washington's teeth and discovering the power of a healthy smile at the National Museum of Dentistry. So, if you're interested, check those out. Now, the answer to our question of the day is 33% of dentists accept Medicaid. That's kind of low, but here's a couple comments from the dentists that that responded. It says, Medicaid is a lost leader. If they ever reimburse for what the procedure, time, materials are worth, I might change my mind. That's from an Arkansas dentist. With all the you know, with all this talk lately of national medical or national dental insurance that might come out of this election, I think that we need to give some thought here. It says, I lose money on each Medicaid patient I see. State promises but does not deliver adequate funding for socially needed projects. Waste and mismanagement undercut the truly needy. So, anyway, we are running out of time, and thank you for joining us. Please tune in next Sunday morning at 9, and we will go over some more topics that are interesting to everyone out there regarding their teeth and their dental health. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230 WYTS with Dr. Brian Kvitko.